So can you remind people what you've been up to since you left the Senate? Now it's been, I guess, almost or more than 20 years, almost 24 years, right?
Yeah. Yes, I was elected in 1976 and served three terms until 1995. And since then, I've been on a number of boards and had a lobbying firm for a while with another former senator from Idaho, Steve Sims, in Washington, and retired from that. And now I live in Arizona and sometimes in La Jolla, California, and still serve on the board of directors of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. That's the one that John Walsh, America's Most Wanted, started. And the International Center for Missing Exploited Children. And so I keep busy, and health is good, thank the Lord. And that's what I'm doing. We travel a lot, my wife and I.
As a member of the Senate, we're reminded that you did help push the assault weapons ban through Congress back in 1994. Describe what that process was like.
Well, it was actually 1990 that the major crime bill was before the Senate. It had come through the a Judiciary Committee, which I was on, and on the subcommittee, and it passed that subcommittee by one vote. So it got put into the crime bill. And that ban, in essence, was the ban that finally passed both houses and was signed by President Bush in 1994. My bill was the first time the Senate had ever banned an assault weapon. And so that was in 1990, and when the crime bill came to the floor, Senator Metzenbaum from Ohio offered an amendment that he could not get included in the bill that would have required registration of assault weapons and many other restrictions. That failed. So then there was an effort by some Republicans in the NRA to remove my amendment that had the ban in from the crime bill, and that failed on two different votes. The last vote was 51-49. It failed. So it was in the final legislation that passed the Senate, but then it went to the House and it never got out of the House, and so it did not become the bill. So the next time around, I was ready to retire in 1994, and Senator Feinstein of California took my bill and tweaked it somewhat and did a much better job than I did, and she got it past the Senate, and then she lobbied the House just fiercely. And did a wonderful job, and it passed the House, and the president signed it, and that was the ban. Now, when doing that, she had to put in a 10-year sunset clause, and so it was not renewed when it came due because of the Republican majority in Congress. And Obama administration tried to get it passed, and it didn't. So there is no ban now. Except the ban that is under the original Weapons Act that gives ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, some restrictions on some weapons, but it's very limited in comparison to this ban and 9 assault weapons and a number of other automatic weapons.
So we know that it expired 10 years later. You mentioned that. There is some dispute, though, about whether it actually worked. Do you think that the assault weapons ban worked? Because research shows that it didn't really have any impact on the on mass shootings around the country.
Well, I don't know that it didn't. I've seen reports both ways. But, of course, it prohibited the manufacturers, and some in this country, from manufacturing the Uzi and the, I forgot the other one, the AR-15, but the other one, the street sweeper. Those street sweeper, and they, you know, those were banned from. Those automatic weapons were not used. The weapon that was used in the Las Vegas thing would have been banned. Now, would that have happened anyway? Maybe very, very likely it would have. That person was crazy, and they could have done it, but can you justify, you know, using a weapon that is for military purposes on civilians, innocent civilians? Now, if you have one that is semi-automatic and doesn't fire or release in as many bullets, I think it's assuming that you're not going to hit as many targets. I can't prove that, but there is evidence that that's the case. In this recent Florida case, that gun, that Cruz, he would not have been able to buy that. And even today, under Florida law, he's 19 years old. He can buy an assault weapon like he used there in the high school, but he can't buy alcohol. So, yeah. You know, that's the argument for it. Now, I understand gun advocates and protectors in the NRA take a really strong view that you can't touch this, but you can. And it has been upheld constitutional that you can put some restrictions. Now, you cannot force people to give up their guns or to disclose their guns under our Constitution and the Supreme Court case. So it's an argument that's been going on for a long time. Will it, you know, bring down shootings? I don't know, but it's certainly not going to help to keep these weapons. If you've ever looked at these weapons, and I have, and I've shot some of them, fired some of them, and when I passed the bill, I had pictures of them on the floor, and that's what I think convinced 7 or 8 Democrats to vote for the bill who had never voted for any restrictions, because they were just clearly weapons for military purposes and not for civilian use. And why should you sell those at gun shows and Walmarts? You know, that's just my opinion, but I feel very strong about it. And I had been legislator of the month for NRA. They'd supported me because I had resisted a number of efforts by Senator Kennedy and Senator Metzenbaum to register all guns, and I didn't think that was appropriate under our Constitution. So, you know, they thought pretty highly of me. They endorsed me when I ran for office and what have you. That fell apart, of course, when I stuck to my feelings that we had to do something about this. It all arose out of Stockton, California, mass shooting that I got very interested in.
So did that have any political consequences for you or Democrats, that got passed at a time when Democrats controlled Congress, and then the following year they lost Congress, and then, as you mentioned, 10 years later, the assault weapons ban went away?
Yeah, I think it did. I think the NRA is so politically effective, and though they don't give money to candidates, they run hundreds of millions of dollars of ads, and it's unknown amount, but some investigative reporter someday will investigate and disclose how much gun manufacturers support the NRA, because that's where it is. It's the money making these guns, and they make a nice profit. And if you start restricting them, you know, guess what? The profits go down. And whenever there's these mass shootings, the fear goes out and, you know, sales go up. So there was some people that lost their election, I think, partly because of it. Senator Jim Sasser maybe was one of them, good friend of mine, and he voted for it. And I'm trying to think who else. Al D'Amato, a Republican from New York, a longtime friend of mine, and we were good friends. And he came on the floor, and he had a lot of support from NRA. And he came on the floor, and he looked at the pictures, and he came over to me, and he called me Big D. He said, "Hey, Big D, what's going on?" He says, "What do you need?" And I told him, I said, very close. He said, "Sure." He raised his hand right there on the floor and voted aye. And it passed. And so there was some, and he lost the next election. The NRA went against him. So there was some. And in 1994, to give you more information than you probably want to know, Phil, a guy named Congressman Brooks from Texas was the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and he had opposed the bill in 1990. I could not get him to let the committee vote on it or let it come to the floor. And Feinstein, with her tremendous talent, I guess, talked him into doing it. And that's the first time he ever crossed the NRA. And when he ran the next year in Texas, he'd been there for 24 years, I believe, he got beat. So it shows the power of the NRA when they come after you. And there was a recall that started in Arizona. Fortunately, I had very good relations with the NRA in Arizona. One of the chairmen of one of the regions out there was a former Border Patrol man and a part-time sheriff, and we were good friends socially as well as politically, and he stood up for me. He said he disagreed with me, but he stood up for me and would not participate in the circulation of petition for recall. There was a split in the Arizona NRA then, and there was a group in the northern part of the state that broke off, and they talked about doing a recall, but nothing came of it.
So just quickly, because I have other things to get to, but do you think the NRA has a stronger hold on Congress now than it did when you served in the Senate?
Yes, I do.
So we recently did a story about your 1976 campaign for Senate. You may have heard about it. What do you remember about that campaign 42 years ago? And can you, Senator DeConcini, draw parallels to what could happen in 2018?
Well, I can. It's a real speculation to go so far back, 40 years. But I had a brilliant young man, Ron Ober, who lives in Phoenix and stays a friend of mine. He was my campaign manager. And Mike Hawkins, former appellate court judge in Ninth Circuit, he was my campaign chairman. And my family worked in it, and a lot of people, a lot of friends. I was extremely, I guess, lucky. I'd been county attorney, and the governor was a friend of mine, and I had been his campaign manager, Governor Castro. And the legislature passed a statewide drug control district to put all the agencies together to stop the flights of airplanes from Mexico into the United States. And he named me as the director of that. And I still remained, I didn't get paid for that job, I still remained a Pima County attorney. So I spent a lot of time in Phoenix working with the state law enforcement, the federal law enforcement, trying to stop these things. And we were modestly successful. My father had been on the Supreme Court of Arizona and attorney general, and we'd lived in Phoenix. I'd gone to high school for a year there, a couple years there. And he had a lot of friends. So when I ran, I had a base in Phoenix, and that was it was very helpful. But I was very active in the Democratic Party. I was at the time, I was elected county attorney. I was vice chairman of the Democratic Party. I'd been a precinct committeeman since I was 21. I'd been a delegate to the 1964 convention, and you know, I just was very active in politics, and I liked it, and I think it drew a lot of support. In the primary, I ran against Carolyn Warner, who was the superintendent of public instructions, and she had been the largest Democratic vote-getter statewide when she won, and she ran against me in the primary, and I was, you know, very concerned with her. But the Teachers Association, who I knew a lot of teachers in Phoenix, they came out and endorsed me. Those kind of things, when they break your way, they really mean a lot, particularly if you're from Pima County, because Pima County is very small, about a third or less, about a third, my recollection is, votes compared to Maricopa County. And, you know, it's pretty strong Democrat still today for the most part. And so you fast forward to 2018, and you have a different political spectrum in Maricopa County and somewhat in Pima County. And, you know, can somebody from Pima County win those races? I think it depends on the primaries. In my case, 40 years ago, there was a vicious, tough, hard primary between two congressmen, John Conlin and Steiger, Sam Steiger, and they were not friends at all, and they ran, and they just tore each other apart. So when that fell apart, we were able to bring a lot of John Conlin's supporters to me, because they were so mad at Sam Steiger. And that helped me, too. In the primary, I was really fortunate because the Arizona Republic, which was a Republican-dominated newspaper, supported me in the primary. That was a real, real big boost, somebody from Pima County. In the general, they did not support me, but I was able to win anyway.
Since you were last elected in 1988 to your final term in the Senate, no Democrat has been elected to that body from Arizona. What will it take for Democrats in 2018 and beyond, besides relying on the unpopularity of, say, President Trump right now, what's going to take for them to get back control of Congress and get the debate back if they want to do that?
Well, Phil, that's a real good question, and there's a lot of speculation. And I think, the Democratic Party nationally has got to do a couple of important things. And Bill Clinton did one of them. They moved the party to the center. And that's where America generally is most comfortable. And that's, to me, why Obama won. I was very almost surprised that he won the second time because he was far more liberal than Clinton, in my judgment. And both George Bushes won because they were more centrist. And the last time we had a real far, far right was Ronald Reagan. But he was a great communicator and a brilliant political person because he changed his views after he took some bad defeats. And people will forget, but he wanted to abolish the EPA, the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, Commerce, not Energy. And, we had a couple of votes on that. And the Republicans were in control in the Senate, and they turned it down. And I had friends there, and they went they told me, Paul Laxall of Nevada and Howard Baker, they went down and they told him, Mr. President, you can't do this. You can restrict these things and pull back. And Reagan was smart to follow that. And Bill Clinton came along after those years with Bush and brought the Democratic Party back to the center and also didn't forget about the working Americans that had long been the base, one of the bases. And then the Democrats, to me, got so far carried away with, same-sex marriage and minority rights, and that is important. But all you have to do is look at the parties and you see who really stands for those rights. And the party spent time and effort and candidates, beating the drum on those issues instead of talking about working Americans and about diversity in the workplace and wage differences. And that affected a lot of people, I think, who were Democrats. And, of course, President Trump, latched onto that. And Clinton was trying to stay in the center and stay with the very liberal part of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has somewhat the same problem, in my judgment, as the Republican Party does. The far right or the far left are not going to win elections. They make you feel good if that's where you're comfortable. And, once in a while you pull one off like Trump did because he could go towards these Democrats in Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania. He won blue states because he talked about workers. And for some reason, they believed him. And they were looking for a leader that they thought would do something for them. It's still a test out to see whether or not that occurs. But that's my judgment on the Democratic Party has to move in that direction if they want to win nationally. And in Arizona, the same thing. You can't be a liberal Democrat in Arizona and think for a minute you're going to win. And I think the proof of that is Bruce Babbitt and Janet Napolitano, who were not extreme liberals. They were able to win statewide elections. And I was too, because I had strong Republican support. I even had NRA support, and that some liberals didn't like that. But I had, I was for the Equal Rights Amendment for women and child care. And, I've spent a lot of time with veterans, and I was on the Veterans Committee. And you have to work at that. And that's what the Democrats have to do in Arizona It was Congressman Kirsten. If she gets the nomination, I think she's
Kirsten Sinema. Yeah.
Her certainly will be for her to demonstrate she can work with both sides, and she's not just ideologically liberal.
You were considered a centrist. I mean, this is no secret. When you served in the Senate and when you were in elected office, where have the centrists gone? You say that each party is moving far to the left, you know, Democrats moving far to the left, Republicans moving far to the right. But is there room for centrists anymore? Can you actually run a centrist campaign in such a polarizing time?
You know, that's really a good question, and I wish I had a good answer for you. I want to say yes. But some of the votes indicate that that's not the case, because people are upset. And I don't know, but I think, you know, social media and the widespread use of communications today make it more difficult to maintain your position. I like to think that the American public and the people even in Arizona are still somewhat centrist. Now, if you look at our legislature, you'd never agree that that even comes close to being the case. But, you know, that's based on gerrymandering and the way the state legislative districts are created. But Arizona is a red state. When I ran 40 years ago, it was a blue state. When I ran the second and third time, it was turning red. And the second time and the third time, it was red state. And I was able to pull Republicans, thinking that I had you know, represented them and the centrists, and I like to think that still can happen. And you look at some interesting examples of John McCain in Arizona. You know, he had to move to the right, running against Mrs. Ward last time, but he was able to do that. And Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, you know, is one that is able to move to the center and been successful. And, you know, our Senator Flake, who certainly has not moved much to the center because he votes with President Trump all the time, but he's demonstrated severe courage to speak out. I know what it's like when you cross the president of your own party, because I did that in my first term with President Carter, and it's very uncomfortable to do that. You know, you have some strong leaders that are willing to do that. But if you're going to be one that just toes the line, whether it's liberal or conservative, to me, that's not what people want. Can I prove that? I wish I could, Phil. I don't think I can. I think the results we'll see. And your question may be right, that there's no room for centrists anymore. I'd like to believe that's still available.
Senator, I have to ask you about for-profit prisons. You served on the Board of Corrections Corporation of America a few years back, now known as Core Civic, runs privately run prisons around the country, including here in Arizona. Are privately run prisons working in Arizona and elsewhere?
Well, that's depends on, you have to look at each state and each contract to see whether or not it works. I was not a big supporter of private prisons when I was in the Senate because, although I changed, because we could not get, whether it was the Reagan administration, the Clinton administration, or any administration, to fully fund the Bureau of Prisons to build the correction facilities we needed and for immigrants and families. And that's how it all got started. And I was there when I think it was one of the first contracts, and we reviewed that on the Judiciary Committee, and I came to the conclusion with Senator Mathias, I remember, the chair of the Republican, that, you know, we had an obligation to and a Supreme Court mandate to treat these prisoners humane and provide security and what have you. And it changed my position. When I got out of the Senate, some years after I was out, I was asked to serve on that board, and I thought about it, and I looked at it, and I reviewed it, and talked to some people I knew at the Bureau of Prisons. They said it's still the same, and they were advocating for private prisons because it was saved them money and save them lawsuits, not being able to take care of the prisoners. So I joined CCA, and on a number of occasions, I went to visit the prisons. I talked to the bureau, the local office, and to see whether or not... Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, sorry. To see whether or not, you know, they were... And they said they were. There were a few cases, and one I remember, I think it was in Wisconsin or Minnesota, where one of the prisons that CCA ran had got out of hand for security, and there became a gang there that were beating up prisoners, and the security people who worked for CCA. You know, participate or permitted that knowingly. Those people were fired, and I think the contract was taken away from CCA, rightfully done. There were then three different private prison corporations, and CCA was the largest one. You know, I felt, you know, Thurgood Marshall served on that board with me, the son of the chief former justice of the Supreme Court, and a couple other former prosecutors served on it, and you know, we brought a balance, I like to think. Does that convince people that making money off incarcerating people who break the law is just immoral or, you know, unacceptable? Probably not. And I have had some backlash from, you know, liberals and particularly the Democratic Party on it, and I've perhaps paid a little price for it, but I felt it was justified, and I like to think I brought some changes, because I offered a number of things with other members that were adopted on what to you know, what to improve things for prisoners and permit some appeal and have an ombudsman that prisoners could do, and that was enacted in CCA. I don't know if it's still there or not, but you know, those were things that I thought were improvements. The debate will go on, but it could all be solved. It could be all solved if Congress and the President would budget enough money to house federal prisoners, whether they're illegal immigrants and their families, or this law broke people who break the law and are convicted. But they will not do that. So if you really want to change this, you have to get the government to fulfill their obligation, which is to incarcerate people who have been convicted of federal crimes. We do not do that, and that's why we even have private prisons today, in my judgment.
You knew I was getting to this on Senator McCain. I know the two of you didn't always see eye to eye, to say the least, politically or otherwise, when you served in Washington together in the Senate. But was there mutual respect, and have any of those wounds healed in the ensuing years?
Well, I like to think that we've always had mutual respect. I know I have, the senator. I respect his military career, and I respect his Senate career. I disagreed with him, and we had a big falling out on earmarks, because I was on the Appropriations Committee and did numerous things for Arizona, the Native Americans, and veterans and other universities and what have you. And he opposed that, and we had some strong disagreements on it. He ended up winning in the long run after I had left, and we still disagree on that. And we had some differences when we were both being interviewed or interrogated by the Ethics Committee on
Keating 5.
Yeah, on the Keating 5 and what have you. There was no charges or any rules or laws that were broken by four of us, and McCain and I both were criticized with the other ones for being too aggressive.
Well, let's remind people, because I think people, it's been a long time, and then you and Senator McCain were two of the senators accused of corruption in the failure of Lincoln Savings and Loan. part of this scandal, the savings and loan crisis, 30 years ago, for those of us who remember this. The Senate Ethics Committee determined that you and three other Democrats had interfered with the investigation, but they cleared Senator McCain. And eventually, you can clarify the story for me as far as how it goes from you. I know they eventually dropped those charges. You chose, though, not to run for re-election while he remained in the Senate. And you wrote about this in your book, but is that hard feelings still there?
No, I certainly don't have hard feelings anymore, and I don't know that he does, but he was not cleared. We all got cleared, except Senator Cranston, who was sanctioned. We all were cleared, and if you look carefully at what the Rules Committee said, that there were no rules broken, Senate rules, there was no laws broken. However, all of us asserted were too aggressive in our assistance of Mr. Keating and his savings and loan. That's what they held. John McCain took a different position. He immediately said, I've been vindicated. And to me, it was somewhat vindication, but it was criticism. And there's no question, in the eyes of the Ethics Committee, we were too assertive. But we didn't break any rules or laws. He and I had a difference of opinion as to whether or not we were, quote, vindicated. I elected not to run for some personal reasons. More than that, in my own life, and that's why I didn't run. And a couple other senators didn't run either for the same reason. For as far as I know, John McCain did run again, and has been successful every time.
And lastly, Senator, you've been out of office for so long, and it's possible that people may have, forgotten about what you've done, and maybe you're too young to even remember you serving. How would you like to be remembered in the long run?
Well, I'd like to be remembered as someone who listened to the constituents, and paid attention to their individual, personal complaints once you're elected. And that's what I like to think my hallmark was, because senators used to refer people to my office to learn how to do constituent service, because that was the rule, the number one rule: answer all your phone calls, listen to people, and that's what I tried to do when I campaigned and after I was elected. I like to be remembered as effective in the passing legislation and in directing discretionary monies that did not add to the budget deficit, to Arizona, to the Native Americans, to the veterans, to the universities, to many causes in Arizona. And there's almost $1 billion in 18 years that were directed there that did not add on to the deficit, but to me was necessary for representing my state. And that's what I'd like to be remembered as. Time tells and what have you. It's just a difficult political environment now, whether you're an incumbent or a former senator or a would-be senator or a congressman, for that matter, in today's world. A recent poll show that just absolutely terrible results of what the American public think of Congress. And I think that's unfortunate, and I think Congress needs to look at that. And just as the Wall Street Journal spoke about President Trump, that his own worst enemy is himself. This was about 3 months ago on their editorial page, which is a newspaper that has been very supportive of him. I think Congress has to look at itself. It has to be more transparent. It needs to pass laws that the Supreme Court says it could, restricting campaign finances. It just won't do that. They need to address the gun issue in some moderate middle ground. And I think people are just fed up with it, and they believe Rush Limbaugh and some of the liberal journalists too, that Congress is just corrupt. I don't think they're corrupt. In our system, corrupt political leaders often go to jail. We have 4 or 5 former governors of Illinois who were convicted of felony. We had one in Arizona, though he was pardoned by the president. We had a congressman from Louisiana, I think his name was Jackson, who had $90,000 in cash in his freezer. Mm-hmm. We had the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Mr. Rostenkowski of Illinois, who went to jail. You know, that's what happens in our system when the rule of law prevails. And it's much better that you don't have to rely on the rule of law, whether you're opposed to the president or opposed to something that a congressperson is doing wrong. And that's where Congress needs to look in the mirror and say, you know, we need to get our act together. We need to be transparent so the public knows who's paying for our campaign. When a lobbyist comes in to see us, that doesn't mean it's bad, because some of them can be religious lobbies, health lobbyists, you know, corporations, labor, environmentalists. That's how our system works. But when they do that and they make contributions to your campaign, that needs to be transparent, not found out by investigative reporters or through some private committee that is not subject to disclosing the funds. Those things could be corrected. Is there leadership there? It doesn't appear to be. And that's too bad, because I knew Senator Reid very well. I know Mitch McConnell not well, but I served with him. And, you know, when you see a guy that I knew slightly, former Speaker Boehner, leave the Congress because he just doesn't want to deal with it anymore.
Well, Senator, former Arizona Senator Dennis DeConcini, yeah. It's been a pleasure catching up with you, and good luck to you, and maybe we'll see you when you're back in Phoenix one of these days.
Yeah, thank you, Phil. I don't get to Phoenix a whole lot anymore. I'm going to Tucson. I'm going to Washington next week, and I'll be in Tucson. We just hang out in Tucson now. When I was on the Board of Regents, used to be in Phoenix almost every week. But and I like Phoenix a lot. I just don't get up there too much anymore. But thank you for the invitation, and thank you for the fine interview. You're really good.
Much appreciated, sir. Thanks again for the time.
Good.